and welcome to the latest edition of Big Mouth, the Thinking Procrastinators pop culture talk show. Every week on Big Mouth, we look at the latest releases and developments in the world of music, TV, books and film, and we try to make sense of it all. My name's Andrew Harrison, and joining me today are from Smash Hits, Q Magazine, NME, Glamour, and once upon a time, the Hibernian publishing gulag, DC Thompson. It is the music writing legend that is Sylvia Patterson. Hello, Sylv, how are you?
Cribbins. Absolutely grand.
Apart from being the Scottishest person on earth, Sylv was one of the key voices of Smash Hits' imperial period, when it sold a million copies a fortnight, bestrode the earth like a colossus, and invented words like jumbo-rilliant. These and other ups and downs in pop writing are chronicled in detail in her fantastic and actually very moving new memoir, I'm Not With The Band, which we'll be talking about later. Sylv, are you responsible for describing John Bon Jovi as wearing spew-gusting crimson perv breeks?
Yes.
That's one of yours, it. Copyright, TM&C. James Joyce, you're over. Also with us, it's Heavy Hitters Week on Big Mouth because we have with us The Guardian's head rock and pop critic, Alexis Petridis. Alexis came up through Rave Bible Mix Mag to edit the late lamented Select magazine. His word can now make or break careers.
Normally his own.
Yes. Alexis lists his interests as gin and the Bee Gees. Welcome, Alexis. How are you?
I'm all right, man. How are you?
All right, jolly good. Listeners will not be able to see that Alexis has the pale and drained countenance of a man who hasn't had a decent night's sleep since Christmas because famous pop stars keep dying on him and records keep coming out and he has to be up at 4 o'clock in the morning writing hot takes.
This is true, yeah, absolutely. I'm actually having difficulty sleeping at the moment, but that's nothing to do with
it. And it's all the problems. It's all Prince's fault. Prince, yeah. Bowie, Victoria yeah. Wood, Radiohead and Beyonce. Yeah, thanks for that pop music. This is Cruelty to Rock 2, rock journalist. Also with us, as ever, is the Chewbacca in the Millennium Falcon with his big mouth, fixing our levels. That's no moon. Hello, Matt Hall. How are you?
Hello. I've not got a mask on, though.
We should have done that, yes. Yeah. That would be absolutely beautiful for the listeners. Okay, one of the biggest stories of the week is that Eagles of Death Metal have been controversially dropped from two music festivals in France. This is following frontman Jesse Hughes' claims that security at the Bataclan venue in Paris were complicit in the massacre of 90 people there in November 2015. In March, Hughes suggested that security guards may have known in advance of the attacks. He apologised and withdrew the remarks, but then repeated them again this week in an interview with Tacky's Mag, the online magazine published by Spectator diarist Tacky Theodorakopoulos. As a result, the organisers of the Rock on Seine and Cabaret Vert festivals have pulled Eagles of Death Metal from the bill. This has caused the inevitable kerfuffle. Back in the Spectator, the ever-reliable controversialist Brendan O'Neill says, Western liberals who banned Eagles of Death Metal are doing ISIS's dirty work. So, should we ban bands from festivals for expressing controversial opinions? Should we judge the art or the artist? Before we talk about that, let's have a listen to some of the Eagles of Death Metal from their 2006 album, Death by Sexy. Here is I Want You So Hard. Before we get into the rights and wrongs of that, Alexis, did you read the offending interview?
I did, yeah.
What did you make of it?
Well, I think the thing of it is that, you know, there was a great deal of public sympathy, obviously, yes. for the Eagles of Death Metal being caught up in the sort of terrorist attacks. If you go back and read interviews with Jesse, whatever he's called from the Eagles of Death Metal, prior to this attack, he was a thundering cock and balls of a man before this happened. His brain has not been turned by these events. He was incredibly right-wing, Trump-supporting, very, you know, some pretty fruity ideas about women's place in society and all this kind of thing. This has not changed, you know, the person he is at all. He's the sort of, you know, post-grunge Ted Nugent or something.
Right.
So it didn't surprise me, the stuff he was saying in this interview. It did strike me that the other Gavin McInnes, who's one of the founders of Vice, was not leading him on, but the two were sort of working themselves up into a bit of a froth, you know. He seems another...
dreadful human being.
I think the phrase you used was thundering cock and balls.
He's clearly another one. I was looking, because I was like, who is this guy reading the piece? Because he was saying these, you know, outrageous right-wing things. At least one of the websites he currently contributes to has been designated a race hate website. According to Wikipedia, the Journal of Record.
Must be right then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know... two right-wind blokes winding each other up. I mean, it's sort of whatever on one level, whatever. You know, it doesn't. It doesn't strike me that, you know, he was just that kind of person.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you get the impression that you're right. They're kind of winding each other up and getting to this crescendo of anger about all the things that wind up right-wing guys. Mm-hmm. McInnes says that he is pro-gun, pro-Trump and pro-life. He recognises that Islam is the problem and political correctness is literally killing us. Great use of the word literally there. Silver, what do you make of this? I mean, does it really matter if, you know, do we care what the private opinions are of musicians?
Well, always, I think it's sadly something that we've lost a lot, you know, in recent years. We're now obviously giving this man an incredibly hard time for having a really inflammatory opinion about something and bemoaning the fact that no one ever says anything inflammatory about anything anyway. But I think, as Alexis says, if Jesse is an unhinged individual anyway, I mean, just imagine the scenario of seeing what that man saw that night. Now, anybody would be coming out of that situation insane.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to be saying some very extreme things and you're probably perfectly within your rights to say whatever you feel like saying. He was the one who was there.
Yeah.
And if it was any of the rest of us, we'd all be in a mental hospital.
Yeah.
I mean, we really would be still. Should we be shutting these people down? Is that ever a good idea? Does that change anything?
Mm.
No. We need to hear what everyone has to say, no matter how unhinged you are. I think opinions are always valid, especially if you've been through this absolutely hideous experience. It just does not get any worse than that. Then, I mean, I want to hear his eyewitness accounts. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was hallucinating.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a case for the band's PR saying the Eagles of Death Metal will not be doing any interviews for the foreseeable future? You know what's going to happen when you put him up for an interview with Tacky's magazine. You know, you know they're not going to be asking him about the gated baseline drum sound on the previous album.
But, I mean, you know, he clearly wants to say this stuff. I mean, I you know, the interview, I read it as there was a lot of egging on, and clearly the, you know, the writer has got a preformed idea of what he thinks of the way the world is going, and Jesse uses his foil to provide, through a horrendous personal experience, you know, confirmation of that pre-existing worldview. I just wonder whether it makes any sense to kick people off festival bills because you don't like their opinions. And it seems to be, you know, is it virtue signalling? Is it you know, we don't want to have this guy as part of our common family of, you know, shared groupthink?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, is there an element of sort of of kicking him off the bill for his own safety? Because if you said all this crazy stuff, it's like the thing with Azealia Banks, where she got kicked off the bill of the Rinse FM festival. Yeah. Ostensibly, she said all this, you know, I mean, really appalling racist and homophobic stuff. Yeah. But I sort of thought, well, this is a grime festival, largely based around grime, in East London. And she'd, in the middle of all this racist and homophobic stuff, had gone, British people can't rap, grime is terrible, I hate it. And I thought,
Queen's,
you know,
a man.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
I thought it's probably for, you know, it's probably best if they don't then put you out on a stage in front of, you know, 7,000 big nasty fans, you know, to me. So, you know, is there an element of kind of, they're using what he said, you know, well, this is unacceptable and he can't be on. But, you know, if he gets on stage there and there's loads of French people going, you know, and then it'll start on again and it'll be, you know what I mean?
Well, the added dimension as well is that he has accused the security at the Bataclan of being complicit or at least turning a blind eye. He's now supposedly going to appear on a rock festival where he will depend on the security for his safety. Yeah, they might not be very happy about it either. I mean, there is an actual business reason why you have to maintain some kind of stability. But I do think, you know, on balance, you know, Ted Nugent still gets to play.
This is it. This is. I mean, are you going to shut down every? You know, are you going to ban Morrissey from playing everywhere? Are you going to ban? Do you know what I mean? I completely agree with what Sylvia's saying.
Well, we
I mean,
happily go and see and you know, pay money to go and see people who have just as batty opinions on the left. People who believe in chemtrails. People who believe that 9/11 was an inside job.
Yeah.
People who believe all kinds of crazy stuff. People who believe, you know, outright anti-Semitic conspiracy nonsense. And nobody says kick them off the bill at Glastonbury. Mm. Nobody says kick them off the bill at Reading. It does seem, and actually this feeds the kind of persecution complex of, you know, the kind of right-wing bro columnist that somehow it's a massive politically correct conspiracy against them.
Well, it's if you put it like that, it does sound like one, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah. You're listening to Breitbart Radio. No, you're listening to Big Mouth. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, doesn't it boil down to the fact that it doesn't really matter what pop stars say politically? Pop stars don't really change people's political beliefs.
Well, they're not the ones in charge or in power, are they? And it's almost all of this is such a big scenario that we're talking about here. This is huge. This is global politics.
Yeah.
This is This is so much bigger than rock festivals and unhinged rock stars being bonkers.
Yes,
it is. It's huge.
Are we still going to listen to Eagles of Death Metal?
Oh, I didn't
well, they're not very
first
good,
place.
Are they?
No, they're rubbish.
I actually quite like, and I generally hate this kind of music, but I actually quite like that. I went to see them at the Roundhouse. I was jolly excited.
Was know. This post, were you showing your solidarity post Bataclan by going to see
no,
them
no,
at the Roundhouse?
No, they haven't played in Britain since then. This was iTunes Festival a couple of years ago.
We're not coming to Britain because it's, what's that phrase? It's Birmingham is Stan or something. London is Stan.
No-go area and other nutty things. Anyway, that's quite enough heavy and depressing stuff. Let's have some beautiful pop music. This week sees the return of three classic pop bands from the 1980s with three very different comeback albums. In a minute, we'll be talking about Enjoy This Trip, the remix album by Dayglow, Plastic Pop Ravers, S Express. And we'll also be talking about Let the Record Show, Dexys Do Irish and Country Soul by the no longer midnight running Dexys. But first, from The Lexicon of Love 2, the sequel to the classic debut from 1982, here are ABC with Flames of Desire. ABC with Flames of Desire from their new, or should I say his new album, because ABC is now Martin Fry, Lexicon of Love 2. No Trevor Horn this time, but Maximum and Dudley's orchestral action there. Syl, what did you make of that? Are you an ABC fan? You're a lover of ABC?
I was a 17-year-old goth at the time.
Get out.
Lexicon of Love came out. I was off my rocker with Killing Joke and Bauhaus.
Right.
And the Sisters of Mercy.
Okay.
So I could, you know, I mean, as well as being a massive pop fan as well, mm-hmm. but that was who my real 17-year-old soul mm-hmm. was. This was very beautiful. Mm. It was incredibly euphoric. I listened to Lexicon of Love just the other day, and it is relentless.
Yeah.
Isn't it? And it's euphoria. It's so sparkly, but it's very, very smooth.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit too smooth for me.
Yes.
It was then, and it still is now. The new one is the same, but not as good.
Mm. Okay, Alexis, what did you make of this?
The thing of it is that if this album wasn't called Lexicon of Love 2, it was just the new album, we wouldn't be talking about it. Mm. I mean, you know, it is... I totally appreciate the sort of impulse behind it. You know what I mean? ABC have been doing that kind of, you know, rewind 80s circuit for a long time now. And, you know, she's doing it very well by all accounts. I thought it was all right. I thought, like Sylvia, I thought it lacked a bit of edge. It sounded like my wife listens to Radio 2 all the time. So it was on in the kitchen. And this just sounded like something you could hear Steve Wright sort of back-annoing. You know what I mean?
The track. Well, they are, aren't they? It's on the playlist at Radio 2.
Maybe that's why. Yeah. It's just one of those things that buys me. I feel it's a slightly cynical exercise. I feel that it's not as good as Lexicon of Love.
It's dated sounding. It is
weirdly
dated.
In a way that Lexicon of Love isn't.
Yes.
Bizarrely. It sounds more dated than the...
But do you think that's on purpose? Do you think they've said, you know, let's go in and make a record that sounds like it could have come out after Lexicon of Love, you know, straight after Lexicon of Love?
I think that, you know, if they had been, if they were an opportunist band, they would have made Lexicon of Love 2 in 1984 instead of making a grunge record and then a kind of Warholian plastic.
I did think, listening to this, what would have happened to ABC if this had come out in 1984? Would they have continued to be, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sort of, I mean, they did continue to be successful to a degree, but I mean, would they have continued to be sort of hugely successful on the scale that they were with that album? And I thought, yeah, probably. Mm. Probably, you know. In a way, it would be sort of more interesting if ABC made Beauty Stab too, or get the little fella back, the little baldy guy.
How to be a zillionaire. And in a weird way, How to Be a Zillionaire, possibly more pertinent in today's 1%, gated community London, who knows. You know, I think this was quite noble about a band basically rediscovering what they're good at and really going for it, you know, remembering that they are entertainers, you know, and he's got this odd thing of sort of slightly straddling that kind of Heart FM rewind thing, but also having his foot in the kind of critically acclaimed classic.
Absolutely,
pop.
Yes.
You know, Human League, Soft Cell, ABC, are of a part. And I'm kind of impressed that he's gone, you know, no, we're going to do what people want us to do and do it as well as we possibly can. Mm.
The lyrics, however.
Well.
Not so great. I did make a note. I'm the singer, not the song. I'm here to serenade ya. Your humble entertainer, I'm here to entertain ya. Not as good as Nirvana, not even as good as Robbie Williams. And there's this tip, is the song called 10 Below Zero? It's 10 Below Zero here in my heart, It's not so surprising there's snowflakes in my room.
Well, you know,
that's not good, is it?
We're coming from the tradition of Philadelphia soul, where the cheese is ladled high and wobbling.
He's also don't complain, mustn't grumble. Help yourself to another piece of apple crumble,
which I love. I've always loved that. You know, show me anybody else who can play. You know, if that was a rapper doing that, you'd go amazing skills, man.
No,
know.
You wouldn't.
You would.
No, you really wouldn't.
You totally would. Is it a bit of a shame that kind of the whole era of ABC and Soft Cell and Human League is kind of, it's all just bundled in as 80s, as if there's no difference between them and, say, Nick Kershaw and Howard Jones, you know, as if it's all of a piece. You know, there are amazing achievements like Dare and Nonstop Erotic Cabaret and Lexicon of Love, and it's just seen as this kind of bit of fun and cheese and, you know, picking the pops on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's a sort of dividing line, isn't there, in sort of 80s pop that comes in about sort of 1983, and the artists that appear after that are Howard Jones, Nick Kershaw. It's all a bit Gimlet-eyed. Prior to that, you've got ABC, Human League, Softail, who are sort of art school-y, you know what I mean? They're coming from a weird background. ABC used to be called Vice Versa and was sort of a very serious sort of post-throbbing gristle, you know. Sheffield, electronic band. So, yeah, I do think it's a shame. But, you know, he's reaping the benefits of that. Martin Fryne has reaped the benefits of that for many years. He's on these festivals with Doctor and the Medics, who I'm fascinated by, the notion.
Yes.
When you go to the Rewind Festival, Doctor and the Medics, come on, right? You got 3 minutes there, Spirit in the Sky, what the hell do they do for the rest of the time they're on stage? What?
Extended jam, I would have thought.
Deep cuts from the album. You know?
Yeah.
What are those girls called? The Anadin Sisters?
The Anadin Sisters,
are they
indeed.
Still with us?
I think they may be different Anadin Sisters. Right. Also, Vom, the guitarist, isn't being
anymore. Oh, no.
At this point, I need to interject that I went to see Adam Ant two nights ago.
Kings of the Wild Frontier. How was it?
It was brilliant. He's still got it.
Did you do the arms? Did you do that?
He left that one until last.
Right.
Which made me think, obviously, because that's not on the album. He played a load of... he played the album without saying a word. He then started talking to the audience and played kind of the deeper cuts, like Car Trouble and Lady and stuff.
Wow.
And Never Trust a Man and stuff. And then he played, right at the end, Prince Charming. Mm. And literally...
The whole
70% was doing the arts.
Were there a lot of sex people out for the Ant music?
There was a lot of old people.
Sex people in the Alan Partridge
sense. Kings of the Mile Frontier.
Very good. Write that down, yes. Well, you can read an exhaustive feature about ABC by me on the Big Mouth website. You can find it via Facebook. Go to facebook.com/BigMouthUK and you can find out how ABC comprehensively sabotaged their own career and then came back. One way they sabotaged their own career was by going fluorescent dayglow acid, not unlike S-Express, which brings us too. Here is the Tom First update of Theme from S-Express from the new remix album. Enjoy this trip. That's bad. No, that's good. That was Theme from S-Express, the Tom First update by S-Express. It's from their new remix album Enjoy This Trip, where lots of modern people like Punks Jump Up and Ray Meng get involved in remixing S-Express's back catalogue. Also, Chris and Cozy from Throbbing Gristle do a mix. Did we like it? What did we think? Sylve?
Well, it was brilliant then, it's brilliant now. Is the remix doing anything more? It just reminds you of how fabulous this one particular piece of music was at number one. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary. And it just makes you feel instantly like you're back in a field in 1989.
Yes.
The sun is possibly coming up. You are insane.
And, you yourself are possibly
the revolution
coming up.
Yeah, the revolution is nigh, is what it felt like.
I really liked it. I thought it was in the range of people that they'd got. You know, you think of S-Express, they had like, what, three major hits, didn't they?
Yeah.
Listen, Hey Music Lover. And actually, you know, the sort of range of people I've got into remix it. Suggests something sort of broader and deeper about Mark Moore as a figure, as a not necessarily as a producer, just as a figure within club land. And
because he doesn't just get David Guetta in
not at all.
Odd people.
The guy from the Horrors, you know, which is sort of a weird thing, and Chris and Cozy, which is quite a weird thing. And I find that really fascinating. I think he's a really intriguing figure, Mark Moore, in that he straddles the sort of world of pre-acid house clubbing and post-acid house clubbing, you know. And the world of pre-acid house clubbing in particular is fascinating. You know, it's a really intriguing, strange world, but perhaps a bit artier and weirder than post-acid house. The one I'm always fascinated by is there used to be a place in London called the Hug Club. And the Hug Club was the place you went to take ecstasy before acid house. And it was just people, pop stars generally, sort of, you know,
hugging each other.
Hugging each other on the floor while they listen to, like, The Cure. They play, like, sort of fake.
You had me right up until The Cure.
But, you know, it's just that sort of thing of, like, this drug, and you don't really know what to do with it. You know what I mean? Until sort of house music comes along and everything clicks into place.
From one marvellous pop character to another equally marvellous pop character, Kevin Rowlands and Dexys return with Let the Record Show. Dexys do Irish and country soul. It's only their fifth album in 36 years, and it's kind of a covers album with reinterpretations of traditional Irish songs, like The Tan I Loved So Well and I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen, with covers like Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and You Wear It Well. We had a good old listen. What do we reckon? Still, you're sniggering to yourself.
Honestly, I mean, there's this lovely piece of traditional Irish meandering.
Yes.
That it opens with, and then suddenly Kevin begins to sing, and it just cracks me up. Mm. I cannot believe that this man is not taking the backside out of the whole situation. It is extraordinary to me. It's really like amateur dramatics upstairs in a Kilburn pub, you know, with the Shillelagh Arms kind of thing. It is really, isn't it? Why does he sing like Vic Reeves' pub singer? It's because he does. I mean, I don't understand the reverence that is given to him in these
definitely
years. I don't understand it. Boys, help me out here.
He certainly demands the audience, doesn't he?
Well, it is a boys' thing, isn't it?
It is definitely a boys' thing. Alexis? Yeah.
I listened to it immediately after the ABC album, and I will be honest with you, my initial reaction... Well, two things happened. The first thing, you always do this when you get a covers album. You go for the song that you really love, first of all. And he does You Wear It Well, the Rod Stewart. One of my favourite records of all time, definitely, sort of Desert Island disc. Yeah. Just a brilliant, brilliant record. And I was really hoping he was going to give it the full Kevin Rowland, because it's a song that can withstand the sort of assault of brrr, all this kind of thing. And brrr, came there none. He sort of speaks it, and I was like, oh, God, you know. But then...
He would have been better off with Do You Think I'm Sexy with his dress back on.
I could totally see their version of that in the kind of finger-snapping Celtic soul style.
But I then listened to the whole album immediately after the ABC one, and it's so mad.
Yes.
And it's so obviously the product of a sort of completely unique mind.
Yes.
That's honest, that's operating according to its own internal logic, that you can't really work out why he's singing these songs, particularly in the way he does. Some of them, you're right.
He's
what he does.
He does
To Love Somebody by the Bee Gees. He sounds like he's pissed. I mean, obviously he isn't, but I mean, he sounds like he's pissed.
You'd
be
better off with a pissed Irishman at a wedding.
But
I've heard better from pissed Irishmen at weddings, frankly.
But then he does Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Yeah.
I find that really moving. Yeah. There's kind of a real kind of like, it sounds like a man on the edge. It sounds like, you know what I mean?
He is.
Do you think nobody said to him, Kev, what happened the last time you did a covers album? It didn't go particularly well,
did
it?
That's quite a good record.
When you take away the man frock from that record, it's actually better than you would imagine.
Yeah.
Particularly the version of You'll Never Walk Alone.
The version of You'll Never Walk Alone is astonishing.
It is astonishing.
It's brilliant.
I think you're right. One of the things that attracts people to him is he's just... He stands alone. He's out there in his own wild kingdom. I mean, somebody's been through an awful lot, hasn't he? You know, addiction, rehab, all sorts of mental problems.
Yes, he's a fascinating character.
He's 12
steps. He really
is,
and he is consumed with fear and self-consciousness, and he's actually ashamed.
I'd also like to raise the wardrobe that Dexys are wearing for this.
I take my hat off. He used to live in Brighton, Kevin Rowland, where I live. And one Sunday afternoon, me and my wife were in Debenhams, and we saw Kevin Rowland in Debenhams in the Churchill Centre in Brighton buying some mugs in full Dexys
fear.
He is a man that is never off.
Well,
him and Nick Cave, you know, we've got two great pop stars in Brighton that you never see him in a tracksuit.
I ran into Kevin Rowland in a Vietnamese restaurant in London's fashionable Shoreditch, and we were just going out for our tea, and that bloke doesn't half look like, my God, it is. And of course it is, because nobody else is going to be out in a pair of Vermilion Birmingham bags, a New York Newsboys hat, and with a D'Artagnan moustache. And he was in the soul of charm. He was a lovely, lovely fellow. Subsequently, he was one of the guests at the Q Awards when I was doing the Q Awards, and he stayed to the bitter end at the party afterwards.
Really?
Yeah, 3 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody left, and there's a DJ playing the Bucketheads. These sounds fall into my mind. Who's out on the dance floor giving it plenty? Kevin Rowlands.
Wow.
This is an admirable guy. I mean, I think it's great, actually, that the record divides people. Personally, I can take it or leave it. I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
I'm a bit mystified by the reverence, but I love him. I love the fact that he will do this.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Yeah,
he
absolutely.
He is indefatigable.
Absolutely. No, I interviewed him a couple of years ago, and... He was. It's a true maverick mind that he has.
Yeah.
But I was not prepared for the level of just he's just this stressed out. He's someone who just can't relax into himself at all. He said, yeah. I am getting better, though, he said. He's just anxious.
Yes.
And he takes himself, the world, and his music especially, incredibly seriously.
This came up a couple of minutes ago. It is men who really like Dexys, isn't it?
The
people who love Dexys beyond words. Why is this? What makes the connection?
I think because they arrived at a time when pop music was about to tip into the sort of new romantic era. It was about sort of show and display and all that kind of thing, and it was seen as being shallow, whereas Dexys was obviously also about show and display in a way that sort of Two Tone, which they were linked to, kind of wasn't.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't dress up like sort of someone from On the Waterfront or something, you know, by accident. But it was so clearly meant.
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean? You could never...
It was being incredibly authentic.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you wrote to Dexys Midnight Runners, you could write to them, and the address was Intense Emotions. Right? Intense Emotions. That is very appealing when, you know, in the same way that someone like the Manic Street Preachers or something, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, the Kerrang! Kids. Yeah. You really respond to that when you're young, and it sticks with people. I know people that are like just mental about Dexys, and sort of not, you know, mental about this weird solo album he made, The Wanderer, which came out in the depths of his sort of, you know, issues. And it's sort of slightly beyond me, but it's about somebody, you know, with no sort of side to them. You know what I mean? It's just that's it. You know what I mean? He really, really means it.
And we do find this hard to deal with, don't we? When somebody genuinely means it.
Yeah.
It tends to...
Well, it's and also... You know,
like Morrissey.
Well, it's like Morrissey, or it's like that just that notion of the sort of auteur pop star. Even now with Kanye West, you know, it's like, well, he's obviously mental.
Yes.
Well, is he mental? I mean, he's certainly behaving in a very peculiar way.
Yeah.
But, you know... As I was saying, what would it have been like?
It's what you want.
It's what
you want. To a huge extent.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just amplified by the fact that social
peculiar,
media...
Peculiar and insane and extreme and all
It's just amplified by the fact that social media exists. And as I would say, can you imagine what would have happened if social media, if Twitter had existed, 75, 76, when David Bowie was kind of, you know, storing his own urine in the fridge in case wizards cast a spell on him or something like that. Imagine, and saying funny things about Hitler.
Well, funny things about Hitler. We'll be coming back to that very shortly, I'm sure. You love the Bee Gees, Alexis.
I do.
Here is Dexys' version of the 1967 single for your delectation.
Could I just say before you play this? This is the estimation from Mojo magazine yesterday, because we received the official press release. I'm just saying to the listeners, do you agree with what is about to be said by Mojo magazine, which is... The considerable degree of interpretative genius in this record should not be dismissed or overlooked.
Let's see.
There's a light, certain kind of light, it's never shone on me. I wanted my life to be lived with you.
Dexys and To Love Somebody. What's the official BG fan verdict on that then, Alexis?
I prefer the original.
You prefer the original?
Yeah, weirdly. I mean, it's been rightly pointed out, he doesn't try and copy, which is a very difficult thing to do, because I think it's Robin that sings To Love Somebody, so he sings in that bizarre sort of strangulated voice that sounds like he's about to cry. I prefer the original.
I think that's fair. You're listening to Big Mouth with me, Andrew Harrison, Alexis Petridis of The Guardian and Esquire magazine, Matt Hall on Faders, and special guest Sylvia Patterson, the legendary pop interviewer and Scots person, who is about to publish a truly brilliant memoir called I'm Not With The Band. It's the story of one girl's epic journey from the frozen wastes of Perth via a subbing job at DC Thompson, home of the Beano, to her spiritual home in the glory days of smash hits. Along the way, Sylv is threatened by Eminem, New Order and Sean Ryder. She falls platonically in love with the Manic Street Preachers, and especially with Richie Edwards. She reinvents the English language, and she sees her beloved music press fall into potentially fatal disrepair. It's also an extremely moving book, with the real-life problems of Sylv's family contrasting sharply with the petty concerns of various popstrolls and lungsmiths. Sylvia Patterson, what made you want to write your memoirs?
I did think do you know, I've probably got an interesting story to tell. Mm-hmm. 30 years in music, media and in magazines generally. The young are very interested in the media these days, as mm-hmm. we know. There's so many, God love you kids, if you are a music journalism student. You know.
Why?
because we, how are you going to live? They're also very interested in the famous. Mm-hmm. To someone who's maybe, you know, 25, the concept of hanging out with Beyonce when she was 19 on a bus to Birmingham is an extraordinary state of affairs. Being threatened by Eminem is an extraordinary state of affairs. Obviously, the lovely prince, who Alexis too had an encounter with. And as well as that, obviously, our profession has disintegrated so considerably it is actually on the jaws of the dumper.
Yes.
And I thought, I've got a story to tell about all of these things. I'll try and weave them together. It was never my intention to write so much about myself, but I couldn't really just be a disembodied voice.
Yeah.
I had to give myself some kind of a context and some kind of a background life. I just thought, well, I'll just try and tell a story that perhaps, you know, a lot of people could relate to outside of our village, if you like.
Well, I think that we talk about the personal dimension, your own life story, because I mean, I've worked with you off and on for years, but there's things that I had no idea were going on, and I just think it's the counter narrative, the parallel that shows that, you know, for all the ridiculous excess and self-aggrandizing nature of the pop business and the media, that, you know, us foot soldiers are not always, you know, it's not always a bath of champagne and, you know, maize and rumpo, as it would say in Smash Hits.
Gigantic chasm between the fantasy of what we do, and as much of it is an illusion, and all of our real lives, all of us.
For a brief period, Select, which I used to edit, was next door to Smash Hits. And after 6 o'clock, the switchboard would go home and incoming phone calls would be routed to all phones, so the entire building would be ringing, because we'd be working at 11 o'clock at night because we were ill-disciplined, and also we didn't have any other life. So the phone would start to ring and you'd pick up the phone and it would be a Smash Hits reader, and they would say, "Can I speak to Robbie, please? I want to speak to Robbie Williams," because they thought the pop stars actually lived in the building in Smash Hits.
Yes.
You know, earlier, "Can I speak to Kylie? Is Jason there? I really want to talk to him." And certain writers would say horrible things like, "He's here and he's just died of a drug overdose."
Who did that to the viewers?
I'll write it down. We can't put it on the radio because it would be libelous. But yeah, that intense relationship that people have with Smash Hits, how much fun was it to work at the zenith of music publishing, the zenith of pop magazines?
It was exactly as you would imagine, and even funnier, to be honest. We just sat around all day long trying to make each other laugh. You know, it wasn't the era where we were hanging about in yachts with Simon Le Bon, or indeed Simon Le Blob, as it was known in the...
Salty Simon Le Bon.
Yes. We were sitting mostly in the office, much like yourselves, later on, till 11 o'clock in it, because we had no other life, and we didn't want another life anyway.
Mm. And it was like a million copies of Fortnite.
Yes, it was.
It really annoyed the NME, didn't it? They used to call it Smash Shit. How very clever that was.
Of course they did.
Because it wasn't about politics. It was fun and it was silly.
There was plenty of politics in it too. Mm. I mean, we would have compilation features about, you know, should we ban the bomb? Mm-hmm. Or should the monarchy be abolished, which would have been Morrissey related, I dare say.
Yes.
So we did big compilations of the big issues of the day as well, which people, I think, tend to forget and like to forget, to be honest, because it was smashed shits, you see.
Alexis, you would have been in short trousers wearing a little Nigel Mulworth cap and riding a scooter at this time. Were you a Smash Hits reader?
I was indeed, yeah. Slightly before the era that Sylvia took over. I probably stopped reading about 1986 when I was 15, because to read it any longer would have left me looking like our old friend Uncle Disgusting. It was mammothly important thing in my life, Smash Hits. And I think you can always tell music journalists that grew up on Smash Hits rather than grew up on the NME, because they're the ones that make the jokes. You know what I mean? Smash Hits was about sort of... It was very sort of post-punk in a way, wasn't it, Smash Hits? Because it was having no truck with the sort of arrogance or the kind of highfalutinness of pop stars. You know, it was about bringing that. The pomposity was there to be ridiculed.
Obliterated.
And, you know, it was about being funny. And, you know, that's sort of something I think I've have tried to do in the past in my own writing. You know what I mean? It's just because pop music is totally ridiculous. It's a completely, if you take one step back from it, yeah, you just look at it, people are, you know, it's just demented. What's going on here? And that's what Smash Hits did. I think it presented it to you as this, it was this world that was totally out of your reach if you were a, you know, 10-year-old in Yorkshire. Yeah. But it was sort of going, yeah, look, this is all happening and you're not part, but it's just so nuts. It's so insane. You know what I mean? That it's funny. You know, yep. It's funny.
I think it was Neil Tennant, wasn't it, that said that Smash Hits, you know, was the magazine that made sure you knew that pop music was both the most fabulous thing in the world and the most, I mean, it just had no importance whatsoever. Yeah. It's all nonsense, but it's brilliant. Yeah. You know,
there's great idealism in Sil's book, and you keep going on about the revolution until such point as it seems like you're the only one left who believes in it, because the pop stars certainly don't anymore. There's one revealing episode comes in the early 2000s when you are interviewing Cypress Hill for NME, and a kind of familiar pattern is established. The band come out with a load of very predictable homophobia and unpleasant stuff. It runs in the magazine and you get the blame. There's a massive kick-off about it. We can talk about the declining fortunes of the music press in a minute, but first, here are Cypress Hill with Lowrider. That was Lowrider by Sylvia Patterson's close showbiz pal, Cypress Hill. Yeah, I mean, the serious side of the book is kind of the decline of pop journalism from kind of, you know, free-spirited Smash Hits and actually, you know, in other magazines, you know, the idea that people would say things because it didn't really matter. And we've now ended up in a situation where you've got controlling PRs, you've also got brand managers running the magazines and the titles who always know better than the editors and always tell you what you're doing wrong. And then outside it, you've got the world of Twitter and all the websites, the news websites, which scour every piece for controversy. So if anybody ever says anything remotely interesting, this is blown up into a great big kickoff. There was a very interesting one the other day when I think the List magazine had a headline saying, Corin Bailey-Ray says, Paul Weller has destroyed me. And then you read the piece, and what happened was he was offering a constructive criticism. You should dismantle your songs and remake them in a different way. He hadn't destroyed her at all. So how did we get here? What's gone wrong with our profession?
This is exactly it. Why has culture done this? I mean, it is extra. I mean, who is actually making this happen? Who wants this to be the case?
Yeah.
Is it just because negativity and malicious brutality from journalism is actually what the public wants?
I don't know.
It actually is bewildering to me, and it's a tragedy.
I think that all the things that you're talking about are part of it, and sort of the notion of pop stars being media trained and all that. But I think there was a narrative that suddenly got put in place when you started getting shows like Pop Stars and The X Factor coming on, which is anybody can do this. You know, they're just like us, which means that people want ownership of pop stars. You know, they want them to be on 24/7, where they're not these remote figures anymore. They want to believe that pop stars are just like normal people. And that's incredibly damaging, I think. And, you know,
it could create a huge resentment.
And it creates a massive resentment, exactly, yeah. So, you know, it's that sort of notion that,
because
you know,
you don't actually have all that much respect for them.
Well, no, absolutely. Particularly if someone's on Twitter all the time telling you about their kind of, you know, their life.
Yeah.
It breeds resentment in both ways, doesn't it? I just find it, it's sort of terrible, really. If I was a pop star, I would go nowhere near social media. Mm. I would, you know, because you want a pop star to be, you want David Bowie, don't you? You want Prince. You want someone that's just remote and weird and fabulous and totally unlike.
But also,
untouchable.
You want people, you want, you know, jolly good interviews where big, amusing, controversial, sometimes very serious, sometimes very ridiculous conversations take place, which is where all three of us have kind of, you know, what we've been doing all our working lives. And the situation now is, you know, that your 4,000 word piece that you sweated blood over, somebody, probably a news site from a well-known brand, will run through, pull out a particular quote, take it out of context. Everybody will feel like they've already read your piece, so they don't need to read it anymore, because they've said, you know, they've read the headline on the news site. And you just ask yourself, you know, why is the entire industry conspiring to destroy its own value?
Yes, and it happens all the time.
Mm.
Two things I will say about this. One is the desire of people to find something negative in whatever you do. Earlier this year, I interviewed Elton John. And, you know, Elton John's a great interview. He's someone that's bought the ability to really not give a fuck. You know what I mean? It's not going to, you know, it's not going to impact on his celebrity. It's not going to impact on whatever he says. Anyway, he gave this great interview. He's talking about his kids. And he said, you know, try and give as normal life as possible. You know, we go to Pizza Hut. take kids to Pizza Hut on a Saturday afternoon and to get the films and da-da-da. Pizza comes up, someone on Twitter, not every child can afford to go to Pizza Hut. It was like, oh, Jesus, wept. Is this, you know...
See, this is the thing, we couldn't hear these voices before. Perhaps they always were there, but we could never hear them. But, the griping, the below the lines.
When I worked at the BBC, you'd regard a letter that you got saying, I was really angry with what you did, or, you know, I want to complain about so-and-so. As evidence that there was like 2,000 other people out there who couldn't be bothered, who still were kind of cross about what you did, but couldn't be bothered to put pen to paper. Whereas now, they've all got Twitter accounts. So those 2,000 people, they don't have to get pen and paper, put it in an envelope, find the address, put a stamp on it, and walk down so that they can just respond.
Well, in the much less scrupulous world of the private media, the non-BBC, you would get complaining letters, but you simply wouldn't run them because you didn't want to create the impression amongst your readers that there were people out moaning about things. Mm. Whereas now that everything's open and it's all hanging out, the impression is, because people who've got strong opinions are far more likely to pile in with a complaint than people who go, that was fine. Mm. So the impression is created that of this poisonous swell of unhappiness and general nitpicking carping that everybody has to deal with all the time.
Isn't that the case with the whole of the news media?
Yes.
Anyway, everything is poisonous and sensationalist and it's about fear.
But
it's
also fear, specifically about the sort of world of pop music, rock music, whatever, going back to the thing about X Factor that I was saying before, it's created cynicism.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because every week on a Saturday night, they showed you how it was done. They let light in on the magic. And you see how cynically these... And it wasn't like anything was not as cynically manipulated 30 years ago or 40 years ago. Of course it was. Mm. But if you show people how cynically it's done, that makes them cynical about stars, about the process, about music generally. And I think that's one of the reasons that people are so eager to find fault with everything, because they've seen the cogs moving, you know?
It's cultural, very much so.
And this is why we should get out of the daily churn of little bitty stuff and we should read great long things like Silve's book, which is a properly authored and guided through thing, which has got a point of view and stands up what it's got to say. The official Big Mouth review of I'm Not With The Band by Sylvia Patterson is It Is Swingo Rilliant, and you should all read it. Okay, so we're coming to the end of the show, and it's, as ever, it is time for closing time chatter. This is the bit where we ask our guests to pass on that thing that's burning away at the back of their mind, that thing that that they're concentrating on. Sylvia, I believe you're interested in Ted Kessler's book.
Yes, Ted Kessler's book, My Old Man, began as a website, a portal for people to tell stories about their relationships with their father. It has famous fathers being talked about, like Pete Townsend. It has famous sons like Chris Martin and the like, and lots of journalists, and all the stories in the book are told so humanly and warmly, and it's a great idea. It's beautifully done, and nice one, Ted.
Well, we're going to have Ted on the show very shortly, so that'll be nice. Alexis, what's been burning a hole in your brain this week?
The Brexit concert.
The Brexit concert,
which was an amazing thing. I thought the minute it was announced, I was like, "Uh-oh."
This was on? Come on.
It was like one of those things you go to at Butlins. You know, it's like ABC. You know, rewind.
Come on.
You know, it gets weird things where people go to Butlins for the weekend. Yeah. There's all bands on, and it's there's different kinds, but there's one specific kind that's like, and the lineup was Five. Mm-hmm. What's the name?
E17.
E17, or whatever, whoever is in E17 nowadays.
Her out of Rolls Royce.
Gwen Dickey from Rolls Royce. Sister Sledge.
Yeah.
And Alicia Dixon, formerly of... Mystique, that's right. But now better known as an X Factor judge or whatever. Yeah. You just immediately looked at the bill. I was like, what's this? Why are these people? Sister Sledge. I met Sister Sledge earlier. These are lovely ladies. I don't really think they're going to have that strong opinions about Britain's Brexit situation.
I've never even heard of this.
Therein lies a tale. Then immediately, members of Five, or ABS, or whatever. Oh, I didn't realise it was a political... It appears that they sort of lured these artists.
Wasn't it called B-pop?
B-pop. But it was, but it's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it touches on, A, what was the point? What was going to happen? This was going to... Nigel Farage was going to come in between artists. I mean, what an amazing gig.
UK Farage.
Were they going to change the lyrics of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Rose Royce working at the car wash with all those illegal immigrants. And then they sort of I believe it's now off. I think the only person left standing is Gwen Dickey from Rolls Royce. For so he perhaps hasn't been informed of what's
appraised,
going on.
Appraised, yes.
But I also thought You know, the Brexit campaign is an interesting thing. It isn't organised along party political lines. I know people of the left, you know, quite major figures on the left that are very much in favour of the Brexit.
Lexit, they're calling it, aren't they? Horribly.
I sort of thought, I wonder if you could you have not got people who actually believed in it? I bet Gary Barlow, I bet he's in favour of the Brexit. You know what I mean?
Possibly Gary Newman.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, people, Morrissey, you know. I bet Morrissey's in favour of the Brexit.
Mike Batt. I reckon Mike Batt would be in favour of the Brexit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what a gig. I mean, hey, wouldn't you go and see that? Newman.
Yeah.
The Wombles.
The Wombles. Morrissey.
Yes.
You know,
well, it would be...
all the greats.
Yeah. As friend of the show, Ian Wade said, and now I'm all alone in Brexit land, my only home. So my closing chat is two things. Obviously, Hodor. Hodor. That was just the best bit of narrative seeding I've ever seen in a piece of TV. Well, the other thing that is probably just as interesting. It's a new magazine. Somebody's launched a new magazine. What the hell? What?
Fools.
What?
Look, you can touch it and everything.
It's called Swipe.
Listen to that.
Swipe is a terrible name. It sounds like you wipe your bum with it.
Sound of paper. There you go. And you can hear that, viewers. It's a new magazine. It's freemium. It's a freebie. It's called Swipe, and it's called the best of the internet in print. And what they're doing is an absolutely brilliant, simple idea. They are curating the internet just as The Week does with the news, and they are running all the best medium to long form pieces from the internet in a print format. And this is a standing joke amongst journalists when we're all told about how the internet's destroying our job. You know, we all say, like, wouldn't it be great if you could read things on paper in a handy format, and maybe it could be sold in local shops that also sell milk and papers. Well, somebody's doing it, and this thing is called Swipe. It is genuinely interesting. And the best thing about it is every single story here is drawn from sites like Fusion and politics.co.uk and Medium. Every page has had hours and hours and hours of editing gone into it. So it's very, very, very high quality stuff in a different delivery method. So if you are near a tube station in London on Thursdays, I believe, pick up Swipe, see what you
think.
Can
I ask a question?
You can.
Does it have a website?
It's got all the websites, Matt. It owns the internet. It has broken the internet and reassembled it in the form of bits of paper. Okay, that's our show. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to our special guest, Sylvia Patterson, and Alexis Petridis. Remember, you can hear the show again and also our past episodes at audioboom.com. Just go there and search for Big Mouth. You can also subscribe to the show via iTunes. Go to iTunes, go to the podcast section, and search for Big Mouth. We're also running some written features about the stuff we talk about on the podcast. If you want to follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/BigMouthUK, you'll be able to read interesting things about Bob Dylan, ABC, and other stuff. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you again next week. Alexis and Syl, thank you.
Pleasure.
We'll see you all soon.
Cheers.